Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. Today, we present the second half of our conversation with John Lundberg. So what's been a highlight for you this week?
I think I maybe have two highlights. They're kind of minor, but worth mentioning. My son started T-ball this last week, which is kind of fun. Yeah, your boys play ball, don't they?
Yeah, we're taking this year off, but yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. We didn't know whether it was going to happen or not because, with all the COVID things going on, but they end up getting this small group of kids and their parents together over at this school. Actually, it's an elementary school that I went to as a kid.
Nice.
And they have a young woman who runs the kind of drills and everything, you know, that you're doing. And it's just kind of fun to see him. He actually gets quite excited about it. And I played baseball from a young age.
Right.
It's one thing that's interesting. I've been thinking, maybe I should save this for the insight. No, I won't. I'll just mention it quickly. Is that I think a lot of parents think that their kids are going to be like them, you know, when they become older. And so I kind of always thought, oh, my son's going to like baseball, which that's no given, right?
Right.
Well, he kind of does like baseball. So I guess nice. It is kind of nice. But, you know, I'm not the kind of parent where I'm like, my son better like the things that I want, that I like. A second quick highlight was I had a chance to spend some extended time with family over the weekend to travel, not far, but a little ways just to spend some time together. And I had forgotten how long it had been in some ways.
Yeah.
Since I'd gotten to spend that kind of time with my sister and my brother-in-law. So it was nice. Mm-hmm. How about for you?
I had two. One was I had a surprise visit from a grad. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think you and I were on the phone and I heard this commotion upstairs and I was like, what is that? Because I heard this voice that sounded familiar. And I was like, no, that couldn't be. And then sure enough, yeah, she's living in North Carolina. And so that was very unexpected. That was fun. So we all got to hang out for a bit. And the other was, so I'm super limited with my hand right now.
Yeah.
But on, yesterday, I think I sat down and tried to play the piano a little bit. And I'm not a pianist, but I like to play around on the piano. And I was able to, and it was just for a few minutes and then I couldn't anymore, but it was just good for my soul.
Yeah, that's great. How about a low light for you?
Yeah, well, so I've kind of started into it, I guess, but my hand. So I had my surgery, which was good. I'm, you know, really grateful to get that tendon reconnected. Apparently it was totally severed.
Oh man.
Yeah. So that's not the kind of thing that would heal on its own.
No, not at all.
But I am trying to figure out what I am capable of doing now, because it'll be about a 10-week recovery is what they're saying, which is kind of a long time. If, you know, I mean, not compared to not having utility of the hand, but you know,
yeah.
Anyway, I was trying to work on my dissertation this last weekend. And I was trying to use dictation. You know, there's a dictation option in Word. And so I was trying to use that. And I realized, I guess I think through my fingertips. Like, I don't know what the words are. I just express them through my fingertips and then I see them and then I interact with them. And so I'm like trying to think of what to say out loud. And I felt so incompetent. Like, yeah. It was just so discouraging. And then, you know, even though the dictation actually, it worked pretty well, but then I had to go back and make all these fixes and whatnot. And the good news is I'm into chapter 3, which is exciting, but I have so much typing to do in the next 10 weeks.
I can't imagine, you know, it's dissertation work is hard enough, let alone adding those kind of hurdles to it. And I always think those text-to-speech programs are always a little clumsy. Like you said, you have to go back and make some of those edits. And I think to myself, like, man, imagine, you know, the kind of editing you have to do when you send a text message to someone by doing and then escalate that out into a chapter of a PhD dissertation. Right. And it's like, now, if you accidentally send the wrong word to a friend or something, you know, no big deal. They usually piece it together. If you don't catch it in your dissertation, you know, it's like, yeah.
Well, especially when you're quoting people. Like,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know. But I think what surprised me was how it really went to just this core area of competence for me. Like it wasn't, this is difficult and unwieldy. It's like, I feel stupid. And that was really unexpected. Definitely a low light. So how about for you?
You know, I had this realization this week that I haven't really been in the office for 4 months or longer, and that it's going to even be longer than that by the time that we're supposed to be back in the office. And I guess normally that wouldn't be a low light for most people, right? That would be kind of a highlight. But, you know, there's something about having space to work in that really can help you to kind of stay on track with work projects. And
yeah,
and I think, you know, I'm not in the mode right now where I have to be fully, you know, immersed in my work at the moment, you know, that we have some things we need to get prepared for, but I can just feel some of that disruption a little bit after thinking about that and thinking about how odd that is in some ways. And, you know, depending on whatever happens in the fall here, you know, hopefully things can go smoothly and as scheduled. But if not, you know, I can't just imagine what life might be like if we're kind of working as these silos in our, right, in our own homes for longer than this. And I'm not at all dispelling that possibility. You know, I'm just kind of pondering and thinking about that. And that might not be entirely a good thing.
No. Yeah. It sounds like that's not something you would be looking forward to.
No, it's not something I would look forward to. Yeah, it's definitely challenging too with having a couple young kids around the house that makes it a little more difficult to focus attention. And I know, I'm sure my wife's feeling that now too as she's gone back to work. So
What's an insight for you?
You know, I talked a little bit last week, I think it was, about some of the research I was doing into the Dakota-Minnesota conflict. Mm-hmm. I did realize, by the way, in our last episode, we need to have a little space where we can make corrections, because I always have a few little errors in my comments. It said something about 1865, but it was really 1862. Anyhow, there you go. That's my correction.
There you go.
It also kind of sent me on this little side rabbit hole trajectory of doing a little bit of research into my hometown, which is Hopkins, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I learned some interesting things about the foundations of the city, and more specifically, actually, about the land that I'm currently on. It's interesting to think that this land was plotted out that I'm currently on at the moment as early as the 1880s. And we're talking about 30 years after the, I'm putting in air quotes here, you all can't see that on the podcast, but after the treaty that was made, the Traverse Sioux on the Mississippi and Minnesota River intersection there down in St. Peter. But anyhow, it's interesting just to think about that. I was just thinking a lot about how there's so much violence, a history of violence in this space, in the town even that I live in. And violence not necessarily meaning physical violence entirely, but just reflecting on the fact that a lot of times we'll talk about America or even as our cities as these idyllic and peaceful places. But sometimes we forget, I think, the history of violence that has existed in these places and in these spaces. That's something that I've just been thinking about a little bit, how the land was exchanged and how land was purchased and bought and how, you know, all sorts of things that happened here that probably a lot of folks would rather forget. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, something I've been thinking about.
Is that the intersection of the Minnesota and the Blue Earth River?
Yeah, I think you're right. I probably got my facts wrong there again. Again, another reason why we need to have a space where we can make these corrections. Yeah, because the treaty happened in St. Peter, but the event that I mentioned last week happened in Mankato, or what is now Mankato. Okay. So yeah, the treaty spot is that one right off of 169.
Got it.
You ever seen that? There's a building there, and there's some trails that you can actually walk back to, but yeah, so you're probably right. I appreciate your your fact checking here. What's an insight for you?
So I've had a number of really interesting conversations, mostly by messenger. It's interesting seeing people that I know wrestle with this question of how to talk about race and everything attendant to that giant category of questions dealing with justice and history and identity, all these kinds of things, but particularly people wrestling with how to talk about those things with their family, which is actually some of what we talk about with John in the second half today. But toward the end of the last episode, you and I were kind of wrestling for, you know, just like just feeling clumsy around talking about that kind of stuff. And I think there have not been a lot of really good paths laid out in our cultural map, right, of how to navigate this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that as I hear from, you know, grads and others who I interact with that are just trying to figure this stuff out and really want to, on the one hand, work for justice and be genuine to rooting out things that are wrong and engaging them. But then on the other hand, trying to say, okay, these relationships matter to me, you know, and you sent an article, I don't know, maybe a week or two ago that was saying either you are racist or you're anti-racist. And I don't know, I think the article made a compelling point, but I think at the same time, if we too easily put up litmus tests and we too easily, you know, say, well, it's either this or this and get into this kind of dualistic thinking, that we don't actually leave the room to do the hard work that's actually necessary if we're going to find any kind of lasting reconciliation.
It can become kind of deflating, right? Like there can be this sense of weightiness or something that can just cause some people to just not want to even think about it or talk about it.
Yeah. So I guess it's not much of an insight. It's just more of a reflection.
Yeah. What were some of the general sentiments that you were feeling from some of the folks you were talking or with, you said through Messenger, just, was it that frustration then of feeling the conflict with family members as it comes to disagreeing about these issues? Was it?
Yeah. The whole range, like from, you know, people saying like, I am engaging these issues and my family's getting mad or my family won't talk to me, to people saying, I am trying to be a safe place for family and, you know, to really do some processing, but then feeling like, am I being genuine to these causes, which really means, am I being genuine to these people who I value, who are being negatively affected by systemic injustice? So that there's kind of this whole range of people trying to say, I care about this. It matters. And it matters enough that I'm willing to be disrupted by it, but I don't know what that means relationally with my friends and family, which I think, I don't know. I think hopefully the episode with John today does a little bit to at least speak to that. Yeah. I mean, he's clearly wrestling with those tensions too.
Yeah, for sure. A few weeks back, I was talking with Steven and expressing some similar frustrations just about conversations I was having with people who are close to me. The pessimist in me always just kind of says, none of us are going to change our ideas. You know, like there's all this movement, at least in the media, about all, you know, the ways that we need to be reflecting differently. But then I hear folks who are just so immovable in their perspectives that I'm like, is there any hope for change? And then I think about myself, like, am I going to change my perspective? And Steven, I guess it was helpful that you brought up a point to me. Do you remember what you said to me?
I know what I'm thinking right now, but I don't know what I said.
What you said was something along the lines of like, well, you know, we're seeing people's perspectives change all the time. And like we went through some of that ourselves, right? And John, the story that you're telling about your experiences with Dr. Perkins and after, it's evidence of the fact that there are people who think certain ways and then who have different life experiences and can be immobilized from their current perspective. And so in some ways there is hope, right? And maybe for some people that's fairly quick movement. I think you said something about that, didn't you, Stephen, about how sometimes that change is actually fairly abrupt and sometimes very quick.
I think people have a desire at least to be consistent. I mean, we're full of inconsistencies, right? But there's some desire to be consistent. And I think when somebody discovers something in themselves or something in the world around them that doesn't fit with the story they're telling, they either have to reject the new story, the new evidence, or say, hey, maybe I need to see this differently. And I think there is a surprising willingness to do the latter, right? To say, you know, maybe what I thought was true about the world isn't, but that's always disruptive, right? Which is, I think, part of what you were talking about earlier, John, is just the sense of how do you love and support people through that and to be gracious in the way that people were gracious with you. I mean, I didn't see any of this, you know, as a kid. I had some good foundations like you, but I didn't understand any of this.
But I feel like I'm still learning. I'm still a project here in terms of discovering some of the realities that people are facing whose experiences are very different than mine. I was thinking, you know, I feel like I'm in process and I like to believe sometimes that I'm like woke or something. But in reality, I just know, man, sometimes I'm just scratching the surface on things that I can barely even grasp.
Yeah. In my experience too, like even if I'm thinking back about what changed it, I never, ever got argued into a perspective change, right? Yeah. I never, ever got argued a separate perspective and came away with going, yep, they were right. Not one time.
Yeah.
Because we're an inherently stubborn people. I've said the same thing about evangelism over the course of, you know, my life. Nobody's ever been argued into the kingdom of God, right? Like, you just need to accept Jesus because he was a real person, because, you know, we have documentation, because the books of the Bible can be proven accurate, because no one's, oh, well, in that case, I think I'll become a Christian. Or at least it's very, very few, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost always because of some work of the Holy Spirit and God that is literally divine and God kicks his way into your heart and drags you into the kingdom kicking and screaming. Or it's as a result of relationship. right? And my cosmic shift in perspective came as a result of a relationship with Marcus Magid and Peter Almeida and John Perkins and Big John Perkins and Philip Perkins and Ken Young and Dante Upshaw and Jim Bear Jacobs and Mark Charles and all of these brothers. And I didn't even mention Elizabeth Perkins, who was a big sister and mentor when I was down there, JP's youngest daughter.
I didn't know that you know Jim Bear.
Oh, yeah. Good friend.
Nice.
And hero.
Yeah, I went to seminary with him and just got to know him a little bit there. But yeah, that's cool. Yeah, how do you know Mark? I'm interrupting here in your thought, but how do you know Mark?
Yeah, kind of through. So he spoke at the Urban Homeworks fundraising luncheon last year. And so I got a chance to hang out. I'd met him at a CCDA like 7 or 8 years ago.
He was at the Minneapolis one.
Yeah. Maybe that,
that was 2012 was probably.
Yep. Yeah. God, that was a long time ago.
Cause he and Richard Twist were there and yep. It was one of the,
that's what it was.
I think my memory is it's the one where the CCDA realized that they had not really taken on, it had not really been aware of native perspectives and actually went through a moment of repentance itself as an organization.
Yep. Yep. For sure. Yeah. So met him through that, you know, spoke again, sat down at the luncheon. And so I'm way better friends with Jim Bear than I am with Mark, but like Jim Miller, who leads the Dakota 38 ride.
Yeah. I was just reading about that today, actually.
Got an opportunity to hang out with him for a number of times. But yeah, the idea that it's my relationship with John and Dante and Pete and Jim Bear, and it's the relationship that changed my perspective, because I can't just hear what that guy is saying, read that book, and then dismiss it because I'm going to go back over here and find what I know to be true. It is, I know this person, I love this person, I know that they love me and care for me, so I have to give what they're saying and their experience credence.
So let me ask you this. This is something we've been wrestling with off and on. Sometimes in these conversations, there's this critical approach that says we must confront the injustice and we must do it loudly and we must do it uncompromisingly. And then there's kind of this other approach that says we must stand firm, but also with love. We were just wrestling with this, I don't know, a week or two ago. And I don't know quite what to do with that. On the one hand, I think the critical perspective is right in as much as it says that the failure to speak truth is not love. On the other hand, if I don't see the person that I want to have this conversation with as fully human and as somebody who is worthy of love because God says they're worthy of love, that I risk perpetuating really kind of a continuation of the same thing, just with a different flavor. Mm-hmm. But I also understand why sometimes people from a more critical perspective say, you're kind of selling out, you're soft selling it. You're not, you know, you're not really committed to justice. You're not really committed to truth because you're too committed to this person or these people. How do you wrestle with that tension? Does that tension make any sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think even the word tension, right, has cultural connotations to it, because where I grew up in a very kind of Swedish Baptist family where I believe wholeheartedly that the Scandinavian people, in a giant pendulum swing away from Viking mentality centuries ago, have gone so to the other side, like, ooh, yeah, all the raping, pillaging, and plundering and all the things. We're really sorry about that. So we're going to go and so far to the other side that we're never going to have conflict ever. We're going to take all of our feelings and we're going to stuff it down deep inside and then we're going to die.
Then we're going to die? Is that what you said?
Yeah, then we die. We take all those feelings to the grave with us.
Oh my, okay.
So, I mean, it's a little overreaction to what the reality actually is. But in order to get the point across, I say that. But I've come to see, too, in my family growing up, culturally speaking, tension was a really bad thing. Mm. Conflict was a really bad thing. In moving into a predominantly African-American environment, or even Hispanic, too, where conflict is something that is like very overt and everything comes out and all of these things in styles that I've seen. Both extremes can be unhealthy. Both extremes have validity. And so I've come to see that tension, especially, can be really effective, right? And we need to be in the tension. Like a few blocks over from my house here is the Lowry Avenue Bridge. The Lowry Avenue Bridge would be an extremely ineffective bridge without heaps of tension. The Golden Gate Bridge would be extremely ineffective without heaps of tension holding it in place. And so bridges quite literally rely on tension to keep peace, to keep functionality, to keep societal rest, if you will. But also unrest happens when that tension is not balanced or people are feeling unheard, right? The Martin Luther King, he's like, you know, I abhor violence of any kind, but I would be remiss if I didn't say that rioting and looting is the language of the unheard. If the tension falls too far to one side, there is a physical response. To every action, there is an equal or greater reaction. So with that tension, like I very much do wrestle with it. And the short answer is yes, both, right? Because there are points at which, and we even look at the life and ministry of Jesus as he exemplified what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to live. There are times he walked into the temple and started just ransacking, right? And there are times where he critiqued the wrong people. There are times where he let adulterers go. There are times where he was very gentle. He was very gracious. He was very personable. And there are times when he acted corporately as well, right?
And so there are times when he was silent.
Yeah.
There's times when he's suffering injustice himself and refusing to call it out at the moment.
Amen. Yeah.
This is tricky. And I've been reflecting a little bit on this concept too this week of speaking out against injustice. Because I saw the sign as I was driving somewhere and it said something like, white silence is white complacency.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Something like white silence is white complacency. And I got thinking about that. And in one hand, I'm very sympathetic to it, right? Like
there's a range of thoughts there, right? Complacency, complicity, and violence, right? Are all associated with silence.
Yeah. And there's something in me that says, yeah, I totally understand it. And I feel the need to say, if I'm just the kind of person who's going to stand by and watch injustice happen because somehow I feel like it's not directly impacting me, then I'm a guilty party. I need to be a person who's vocally speaking up against it. On the other hand, I feel overwhelmed at times thinking there's a lot of injustices in the world, a lot. And I don't speak up vocally, publicly on a lot of them.
Yeah.
I don't believe that child trafficking is just. I haven't made it a platform to speak out against it vocally, even though if you were to ask me, right, am I being complicit to it? I hope not, right? It's this trickiness in trying to figure out. And then there's the other component of, is that just white people feeling the need to have their voices pushed to the front of the conversation again, where I'm like, look.
So it's actually a perpetuation of the same thing.
Yep. That's the problem. I get these kind of pessimistic thoughts in me while on the one hand, understanding its sentiment and thinking, yeah, we can't be silent. On the other hand, if you think your voice is the most important here again, think twice. I'd rather be silent 1,000 times than to press my voice to the forefront and believe that somehow you better hear me, you know, especially in the conversation of racial injustice and inequality. What do I know? You know, I feel terribly ill-equipped and unprepared, and I feel like a non-authority on the subject. So that's just something I've been wrestling with. You know, Stephen, you're talking about the tension between being truth speakers and people who stand against injustice and loving those people who are not so quickly movable from their perspective. And I'm wrestling with this question of speaking up versus not pushing my voice to the forefront. And I don't know the answer. What do you think, John? Tell me what to do.
I've got your answer right here.
Exactly.
And I've wrestled with that too, particularly around recent events, right? I know that a lot has happened within blocks of my house. I live just off Broadway in the north side, and I could see the flames of O'Reilly Auto Parts from my front porch. I pulled a couple of all-nighters with a couple of neighbors because we had people that were calling us, church leaders were getting calls from the FBI saying we have credible threats to areas of the city. Please either leave if you have the ability or be very cautious if you don't and rally together. So we were outside all night long, sitting in front of our houses.
You posted on Facebook one of those times and said, I think you said that this had been the hardest week of your life. Is that right?
It absolutely was. I'd pulled two all-nighters. I hadn't done that since college. Two all-nighters of literally sitting out in front of my house thinking there is a possibility somebody shows up to do me, my neighbors, and my possessions harm. And even the threat of that, I mean, we called in three different cars that drove up my block with three white dudes in masks that were in a car with no plates. Mm-hmm. And that was terrifying. And so one of my neighbors actually jumped in his car and followed him for a while. The next day I walked up, I'd wake up at like 8 if I got any sleep, and I'd walk up about 8 blocks and then down to Interstate 94 and then back, just to kind of see what had happened. Cause at 7, 8 in the morning, nothing's going on. But I got a block up from my house, literally 200 yards from my house. And there was a car with no license plates that was sitting on the side of the road with two full gas cans, a number of pry bars, masks, and multi-tools in the back seat. Nobody was in it. Mm. That's terrorism. And so with all of these conversations, and sorry, that's sidebar to get back to actually your question, Justin, what I started grappling with was, in this time, as a white person, I do believe it is incumbent upon me to use my platform to amplify the voices of color that for too long have been sidelined and not allowed into the greater conversations that have been going on about economics and politics and society and all of these, and theology, all these things. At the same time, I'm wrestling with the recognition that many of my family members and many of my community members that know, love, and trust me and my voice to a degree will not hear it if I simply amplify that voice and give credence to it because of where they're at. And so I then felt the burden to attempt to put into words what I was feeling, what I was thinking, and bringing validity to the conversation with my voice specifically. And so I think that too, that's the tension of when is it appropriate and necessary to amplify others' voices and push that conversation in that direction? And when is it appropriate and necessary to use my own platform and use the white privilege that I have, use the seeming normality to bring the conversation to a place where white voices, white ears can hear the voices that we're amplifying? And that's that mushy line that I think requires us, especially people of faith, to go back to the Lord. One of my favorite prayers in the Bible is the prayer of Nehemiah, right? Because his
I thought you were going to say the prayer of Jabez.
I can get into that one. But Nehemiah, right, he is confronted by the people that have come back from his hometown and told him about its state, and his heart is broken. And he has this overwhelming conviction to do something. And his prayer was not, Lord, tell me what to do. His prayer was, I'm going to do this. Lord, give me success in this. Hmm. Right? There was a conviction, and God gave us, I mean, one of the things that JP said, he's one of the greatest statements that John Perkins ever made that has been cemented in my mind forever. John M. Perkins, was prayer is a preparation for action, not a substitute for it. It's the best. And that's what Nehemiah is doing. God gave us wisdom. God gave us a brain. God gave us a heart and a soul. And a lot of times we can act in those convictions. And when we're acting in those convictions, God can give us success or he can give us failure. But Nehemiah is saying, my heart is broken. My attitude and will and desires are pure. Lord, give me success before this man today, as he's going to go ask the king to essentially bankroll rebuilding a town that was an enemy.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. No king does that. But the Lord does give him success in that. And so when we're trying to navigate that line of, is it time to amplify my voice? Is it time to have an argument? Is it time to sit back and wait and allow something else to happen, to allow the Holy Spirit to marinate in someone else's heart? What's happening in these things? That prayer and diligence of, this is what I think I need to do. But there is, I think, the lesson in Nehemiah taking the time to do it as well. Because we can also do it in reactionary fashion, right? Somebody says something happens, and we get out there and bam, we're going to react and we're going to yell and we're going to scream and we're going to holler. when actually, and there's precedent for Jesus doing this too, right? Even when he was being bombarded by people about the adulterous woman, he pauses, he gets down, he writes in the dirt. And there's probably a super awkward silence and pause there as he begins to formulate and process through some words that are about to come out. And then, of course, he has the most brilliant response in the history of mankind. Yeah, sure. Go ahead, stoner. If you've never screwed up ever. And so I think that it's incumbent upon us to be thoughtful, to be aware, to be mindful, to be gracious and loving. Because I think some of the responses of standing for justice when we want to do it do come out of a place of anger, frustration. And I have found, especially in arguments and in confrontations with my family, a lot of those come out of places of anger and resentment. Mm-hmm. And those are never fruitful because it's not necessarily even a righteous anger. It's a very personal anger that you wouldn't believe me. You don't give me credibility or whatever.
Let me just grab onto that, because I think that's really important that if we're engaged in justice work, but it is an expression of our own insecurity or of our own anger, if we're not settled, and I don't mean if we don't settle, I mean, if we are not stable, if we're not connected to the source of life and we're trying to engage these kinds of things, gosh, not only do we need wisdom from the Spirit in the moment, but I think there's this sense of if you're standing on one foot and somebody pushes back on you a little bit, you know, I mean, what's going to happen? Well, suddenly, you know, what was maybe even just reaching out to you makes you unstable and you feel attacked.
Legit, absolutely.
And so if I'm going in to have a conversation with somebody, it's important that I'm steady, you know. Mm-hmm. The risk to that is saying, well, I gotta get really stable and steady. And sometimes what we mean is I have to build.
And I'm not going to engage anything until such time as I'm okay. Sometimes what we
mean is I have to build my fortress first. And that's not what I mean. It's like, you know, I gotta get loaded up with all the ammunition and everything. I don't mean that, but I think that there is this sense in which sometimes we do displace conversations, frustrations that are actually about something totally different, and we displace those onto these conversations about justice, and that's not healthy. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean the justice conversation doesn't need to happen. It means that we've got to do the hard work of being humble and ready, and I don't know.
Absolutely. And I think you hit on what I've come to as a result of the last few months when it comes to this conversation. And it's not a new concept. It's a biblical concept that we continually must rediscover. And it's the concept of humility and grace, right? Like one of the primary issues in white people neglecting or at worst and at best being ignorant of the issues and plight of our African American brothers and sisters. Well,
I think at worst, probably perpetuating, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It is the lack of humility.
Yeah.
Coming to a conversation, recognizing that I don't have all the answers, right? One of the things, I know one of the things that you had kind of asked and that I've been marinating us on is what do we want followers of Christ to recognize or know or sometimes understand? And one of it is like, don't be so convinced of your own rightness, right? Like even one of the things I've grappled with, and I'm a theology major. I love the Bible. I love Jesus. I love God. I mean, every decision that I'm making in my life to stay planted right here where I believe God called us in the midst of the chaos and the craziness is that it was God who planted us here, and I don't believe he changed his mind. Mm-hmm. So I love God and I love the scriptures. I'm passionate about the scriptures, but I also understand that and have asked many the question, how many pages does it take to adequately sum up and describe the personhood or the entity, the wills, desires, whims, emotions of an omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent being that created well over 350 billion galaxies. Most are bigger than ours, each containing over 100 trillion stars, many of which are larger than our planet. how many pages does it take to adequately describe that being? And the answer is way more than 2,000. It is, at best, it's Cliff's Notes. At best, it's Cliff's Notes. It's the best thing we have. I love the Bible, and I will hold to it. I will give my life for the truth held within it. But at best, it's Cliff's Notes describing that type of entity. And when I come to that in humility, I have to recognize that, whew, how inadequate am I to the task if the kind of inerrant word of God handed down to us is inadequate to describe him, not inadequate for what we need.
John says that, right?
Yeah. And there's some
John, meaning the Gospel of John, or John Perkins?
No, sorry, the Gospel of John.
Or John Lumberg. We got so many Johns today.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that there is in no way enough volumes in the world to adequately describe all that Jesus did.
Exactly.
And said. We can't do it. And going back to Paul too, right? Like, this whole thing is mysterious. This whole thing, at best, we're looking through a dirty window, Paul says, and in the John Lundberg version, the JLV, not an officially church endorsed version, I will say, not sanctioned, but that idea that, and so many of these conversations could go so much better if we were willing to come to the table and all be willing to say, I don't have all of the rightness. I don't have all of the answers. I got some really good ones, some ones that I think we can all hold to that become quite central, but I am not the keeper of rightness. And there are brothers and sisters all over this world that look way different than me, that are way smarter than me, that bring perspective to the scriptures and perspective to Jesus's life and words and teachings that I need to understand in order to get a fuller picture of God. Not like, oh, that's good, that's nice, that's fun. No, necessary. Mm-hmm. It's necessary for me to know. Otherwise, my God is too small. And I think one of the things that I've recognized, again, back to the whiteness question, coming out of whiteness and being able to look back at whiteness, I'm going, wow, is that small? Mm-hmm. Wow, was my God small? Wow, was Jesus's life limited? Mm-hmm. And when we get... And see the full color and the full ramifications of the full gospel, God becomes bigger. God becomes more powerful. God becomes more beautiful. And it's part of the reason, I think, why many of us in these conversations, especially theology, are so passionate about it, because it is like taking the gospel to someone who's never heard it. Like, we are so passionate about it because it's so beautiful and it's so amazing. And we want you to know and to recognize how it's like jumping onto a page with a stick figure and trying to explain to the stick figure what it means to be three-dimensional. It's amazing. There are things that are spherical. And you can reach out. Because we at least believe that we see it that way. And that's why we become very impassioned about what we think, because we think it gives so much more weight to the words of Jesus as well. And we want people to know. And that passion can sometimes lead to more tension.
This has been a helpful conversation for me. I think reframing tension, right? Not as something to be resolved, but as something to be held, thinking about the humility that is the appropriate response. So if we're right theologically that God is infinite, and I can't remember who first brought this to my attention, but the idea that the finite could grasp the infinite is just silliness. You know?
Yeah.
And so, it's just,
no way.
It's what's always bothered me about doctrinal statements is we try to kind of calcify God in these statements and assume that, well, this is just kind of the given. And a former professor of mine had said, the minute that you do that, you know, you're basically encasing God as a sort of fossil, and you never actually go back and revisit your thoughts about God by just making these claims that are kind of just a given. And I'm not saying this because everything should be considered and there's no room for like considering standardized doctrinal things about God, but it's just a frustration that we seem to try to limit God sometimes. And we're also...
Absolutely. We make him look like us, which is part of the problem.
Yeah.
Everybody does.
Which is where not knowing then that you've constructed the world around your whiteness, for example, has theological implications,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Look at the paintings in our churches going back hundreds and hundreds of years. Whatever church you go into, for the most part, on whatever continent, they have a picture of Jesus. And that picture of Jesus looks a hell of a lot like them. Like Jesus in my church growing up was the blonde hair, blue eyed Jesus. Mm. He looked a lot like me. Mm. And that helped me identify. So if we physically make Jesus look like us, of course we theologically make Jesus look like us. Of course we go into the scriptures and we read passages that make sense in the context of our culture, our neighborhood, our homes, our feelings. And when we construct that too long and we don't teach our kids the cultural ramifications that are bigger, we get to age 20, 30, 40, 50, and we're not changing our minds on any of that. Like, no, this is what Jesus looks like because we never saw anything bigger, or we refuse to recognize that, well, yeah, I make him look like me and so does everybody else. And everybody's picture rolled into one mosaic may make up a more comprehensive picture, but I'm not willing to do that because now everything has been so in line with that way of thinking that I can't make my way out of it, or it's really hard to.
And I think that that does maybe speak to the other side of it, which is when we confront some of these things, when we get into some of these conversations, they literally are scary to people.
Yeah. Yeah. For real, because you're shaking the foundation on which their worldview and ethic is built.
Yeah. Mm.
Fellas, I have to get my little one to the doctor.
Yeah, yeah. I know, we're running long here.
That's okay. I love running long because, as you guys know too, I'm very passionate about this.
Great chatting with you, John.
Always. But I would... My son just came over the intercom over here on the baby monitor. Dad, like, there you go.
Leave. Hey, thanks so much for being with us, John.
Good to see you.
Absolutely. Totally a pleasure. Anytime you guys need me, I'm here.
Appreciate it.
Love it.
Hey, have a good one.
All right, brothers. We'll see you.
Yep. Talk to you later.
So I really enjoyed this conversation with John. And I think in some ways, you know, this episode, the second half is maybe a little more hopeful here at the end than the first one. But I think I just really resonated with was this language that he used to describe bridges, that they function because of tension, and that tension is not necessarily something that we need to resolve, that actually holding the tension is exactly what a bridge does. It's how it works, right? Huh. And of course, he's talking about a suspension bridge. But I think you know, this idea that if we are bridging, if that's part of what we do, there will be tension. And that is not a sign that something's wrong.
Yeah, in some ways, maybe to resolve that tension would be indicative of having maybe left the bridging area. How do I put it? You know what I mean? Yeah. So in some ways, maybe, you know, having a lack of tension then would be indicative of the fact that maybe we've quit becoming a bridge.
I think along those lines of trying to ground the conversation, I have gotten a little bit concerned about some of the conversations in the American
dialogue
public space. Yeah. That I feel like there's this real risk toward conversations that are happening in ways that are not generous, that are not invitational, and end up risking missing out on voices that are really relevant.
Yeah.
So I have in my own family, people who are opposed to one another, at least in theory, but then you get the people into a room together. And often if you can find that shared humanity, there's at least a starting place to say, you know what, like probably you're not trying to be evil.
Yeah.
Right. On either side of that conversation. That does not mean that we don't have evil consequences.
Yeah.
Totally do. But often the intention isn't. Now, and I cannot say that it never is. It's clearly sometimes the intentions have been awful. And this is part of where I think we have to be really honest about our history. But to try to find what is that shared humanity, you know, what values do we have in common? What bridges can we build? And then can we find that together space in a way that is also honest to the very real disagreements that we have?
Yeah.
Not minimizing them, not saying that their disagreements aren't real. They totally are real.
Yeah.
Right. But we, I think, can find a space to bring those things into dialogue. Does that make any sense?
It does. It makes a lot of sense. I think you put it well. I don't always know how to navigate that tension. I like to live in it too. And recently, I think someone said to me that maybe that's a cop out in some ways, like living in that center space, because sometimes it can cause you to not have to commit to real acts of social justice. But at other times, I feel like,
or environmental justice, or, you know, I mean, it's,
yeah, yeah, or, it goes, yeah, or any other issues of justice. Yeah. And I think there's something to be said about that. There could be this temptation to, when you're kind of trying to live in that space, and I don't want to call it middle space, because then it sounds like you're actually, you know,
compromising or something.
Yeah, compromising. What I mean, though, is living in a space where you're trying to hear both sides of the conversation in a way that's not demonizing the people inherently without hearing their perspective. I don't know. I think that bridge idea is helpful, but there is a temptation, though, to maybe not have to land in a place that requires some critique at times. Or
and we can't all be bridges, right?
No.
I mean, if we're all bridges, then there's nothing to bridge between.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, is it a cop out? Is it actually being unfaithful to both? Or
yeah.
Every now and then we've talked about intercultural theory, and I just want to throw this out. The DMIS, the Developmental Model of Intercultural Sensitivity, or the Intercultural Development Continuum. Well, it's actually only on the Developmental Model of Intercultural Sensitivity. There's this stage called integration, and integration is the sixth stage. It's the furthest stage on the DMIS. And when Bennett was teaching about this, one of the things that he said is, you know, this is not really a necessary stage, but it's an experience very often in people who live in adaptation. So this capacity of frame shift to go back and forth between different perceptions of the world. And one of the things that I think is true with the integration stage is that there is just this tremendous amount of tension, because if you can honestly perceive both sides of an issue as legitimate over and over and over again, who are you? Because
yeah.
If you have two opposing, and this can be issue-based, it can be group-based, right? There are different ways to think about this. But if you have group A and group B, and the, again, could be ethnic groups, racial groups, political groups, ideological, whatever. Group A, if they believe that group B is a threat, and if I frame shift into group A and I understand the group A experience of the world, which includes group B being a threat, but then I also frame shift into group B, which maybe perceives group A as being a threat, and I can experience the world that way and I can understand why, like, I am immediately unfaithful to both. And at the same time, there's this new reality that opens up because both have legitimate perspectives.
It can collapse into an unhelpful phenomenalism where you basically then just end up with all that matters are people's subjective experiences, and there's no way to evaluate. In some ways, there's no problem with that on some micro levels. Where it can become so problematic is when then all ethical issues kind of become just personal perception. And it's like, at what point then can society ever proclaim something to be?
And this is where I think attention to, this is part of why I think the academy matters, because some of those philosophical questions require really deep thinking and processing, right? Yeah. And like, if I'm only on the ground, I may not have the space for that to think through what are the epistemological implications of seeing the world in multiple ways, and then what does truth look like? And I do think that, you know, we've talked some about critical realism as a way to engage some of those tensions, but I honestly think this is one of the most important areas of inquiry for the next, you know, 50-100 years. I don't know, maybe I'm off on that, but I just think, so post-postmodernism has this intensification of everything, right? Yeah. You have people on every side of every issue more intensely engaged with their side of their issue, and the capacity to find truth in both and to critique truth claims that are not accurate in both, or, you know, in multiple sides of things. Yeah. And then to find some kind of epistemological, moral ground, ethical ground to say, hey, let's work through this.
This is an interesting thing you bring up, though, even thinking about this concept of tension, because I wonder if there's times where I'll feel that tension and I'll want to remove it. Mm-hmm. Because it's uncomfortable. And yet I think, isn't that just it? That the only way to remove it is to essentially quit participating in the conversation or in trying to navigate the difficulty.
or to give yourself over to one side or to the other, right?
Yeah. Or yeah, it's true. And in some ways it can become a little bit of a cop out, right? Just to get rid of the tension, to kind of move in any of those directions.
Well, and I think part of what's really fun about what John does is he presents something different as a possible alternative. I think some of our metaphors maybe are a little bit worn, but you know, of a mosaic or something, but there's this sense in which as we learn to see that each of us has a limited theological vantage point, you know, that as we read scripture, that we're coming from a point of limitation necessarily because we're finite, right? We just literally are limited, that then each other becomes another point of refraction, right? Becomes another point of reflection, becomes another way of seeing the beauty of who God is.
And sometimes in theological circles that there's this tension of feeling like the multiplicity of perspectives is a reflection of a distortion, right? Like somehow if people don't all see the same way, maybe it just means that we've all got it wrong, kind of idea. And I don't really see it that way. We can't become fully optimistic as if every perspective that exists theologically somehow forms this massive continuity of a whole that is therefore like the best thing it could possibly be, right? There are conflicting perspectives in there that can't mesh and blend together at times. But I do have the kind of optimistic perspective that like, because of our limitations, the more perspectives that we can see and that we see humanity offering theologically, the closer maybe that we can get to the beautiful picture of who God might be, right?
I can hear somebody saying, but wait, like, isn't there truth?
Of course, you know? Yeah.
Which of course is part of what you're saying is like, well, yeah, but it's more complicated than we sometimes act like it is. But I think that's maybe where rooting our experience of truth in scripture, which is a very complex undertaking, right? Actually, hermeneutically and otherwise, but it does suggest that there's an authority beyond my phenomenological experience of truth or my phenomenological gathering of everybody else's phenomenological experiences of truth, that there is something. I mentioned this in the social constructivism book, that truth has revealed truth self to us.
Yeah.
In multiple ways. You know, we have theologies of revelation, not the book of Revelation, but you know, the theologies of ways in which God has revealed God's self to us. And so we're responsible to that information.
Yeah.
And we have to wrestle with it. If scripture is what we believe scripture to be, which is one of God's most important revelations to us, then we have to engage that as we try to figure out what truth is.
Yeah. And you and I have talked about this before, but there is a difference between saying that we've got an authoritative source and that me as an individual 100% clearly perceives the meaning of that. So there's this conflation sometimes of so-called objective truth and me obtaining it perfectly through my individual perspective or my community even. Mm-hmm. And that could be a major danger, right? So I want to hold those two up at the same time while not at all rejecting the concept of the authoritative source and of objective truth, while at the same time noting that my own self and even my own community may well have some significant limitations to actually accessing that reality. Mm-hmm. It's a big philosophical conversation, but not one that's unrelated though to these things, right?
No, I mean, it's deeply related.
Yeah, we're talking about the necessity too of hearing voices other than the ones that we're used to hearing and seeing, as John's brought up. And on the one hand, seeing that is extremely valuable. On the other hand, not conflating it into some idea of individual perspectives are all that matter. And that somehow the goal is just to hear the most perspectives or something. Mm-hmm. But there is a sense of having a deep need to respect the way that other people are thinking theologically because of our own personal and communal limitations.
Yeah.
Without at all taking away from the authority of something like, say, the scriptures. Right.
We won't solve it today.
We won't. No, we're not ever going to solve it.
No. Thank you for joining us today for Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. For show notes or to contribute to production costs, visit profsinrooms.com. Lindsay Zell was our editing assistant for this episode. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.